ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरये नष्टप्रायेष्वभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भगवद्युत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 9, Answers by Citing the Lord's Version, Text 23. Pratyadishtam Mata प्रत्यादिष्टं मया तत्र त्वयि कर्म विमोहिते तपो मे हृदयं साक्षात् आत्माहं तपसोन्नघ Pratyadishtam, ordered maya, by me, tatra, because of, tvayi, unto you, karma, duty, vimohite, being perplexed, tapaha, penance, me, unto me, hridayam, heart, sakshat, directly, atma, life and soul, aham, myself, tapasaha, of one who is engaged in penance, anagha, O sinless one. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. O sinless Brahma, you may know from me that it was I who first ordered you to undergo penance when you were perplexed in your duty. Such penance is my heart and soul, and therefore penance and I are non-different. Purport. The penance by which one can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face is to be understood as devotional service to the Lord and nothing else, because only by discharging devotional service in transcendental love can one approach the Lord. Such penance is the internal potency of the Lord and is non-different from Him. Such acts of internal potency are exhibited by non-attachment for material enjoyment. A beautiful sentence. Such penance is the internal potency of the Lord and is non-different from Him. Such acts of internal potency are exhibited by non-attachment for material enjoyment. Srila Prabhupada's purports are so pointed and so clear and deep. Every line. So I'll continue. The living entities are engaged in the conditions of material bondage, because of their propensity for overlordship. But by engagement in the devotional service of the Lord, one becomes detached from this enjoying spirit. The devotees automatically become detached from worldly enjoyment, and this detachment is a result of perfect knowledge. Therefore, the penance of devotional service includes knowledge and detachment, and that is a manifestation of the transcendental potency. One cannot enjoy material, illusory prosperity if he desires to return home back to Godhead. One who has no information of the transcendental bliss in the association of the Lord foolishly desires to enjoy this temporary material happiness. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is said that if someone sincerely wants to see the Lord and at the same time wants to enjoy this material world, he is considered to be a fool only. One who wants to remain here in the material world for material enjoyment has no business entering into the eternal kingdom of God. The Lord favors such a foolish devotee by snatching all that he may possess in the material world. If such a foolish devotee of the Lord tries to recoup his position, then the merciful Lord again snatches away all that he may have possessed. By such repeated failures in material prosperity, he becomes very unpopular with his family, friends, and relatives. In the material world, the family members and friends honor persons who are very successful in accumulating wealth by any means. The foolish devotee of the Lord is thus put into forcible penance by the grace of the Lord. And at the end, the devotee becomes perfectly happy being engaged in the service of the Lord. Therefore, penance in devotional service of the Lord, either by voluntary submission or by being forced by the Lord, is necessary for attaining perfection. And thus, penance is the internal potency of the Lord. One cannot, however, be engaged in the penance of devotional service without being completely free from all sins. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, only a person who is completely free from all reactions of sins can engage himself in the worship of the Lord. Brahmaji was sinless, and therefore he faithfully discharged the advice of the Lord, tapa, tapa. And the Lord, being satisfied with him, awarded him the desired result. Therefore, only love and penance combined can please the Lord, and thus one is able to attain his complete mercy. He directs the sinless, and the sinless devotee attains the highest perfection of life. Om Ajnanatimirandasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Tadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Gurah Shri Yutapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Nitinamine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna. The Supreme Lord is reminding Brahma that it was I who actually ordered you to undergo penance by speaking the words tapa, tapa. Tapa in Sanskrit means austerity or penance. So when these words were spoken, Brahma could not see the person who was speaking them. He simply heard the words like a voice coming in from the sky. And he dutifully followed that instruction. He was intelligent enough to understand that these words were not being spoken by any ordinary person, that they were directly being spoken by the Lord, and that he was expected to do this if he was to solve the problem of his bewilderment. Brahma's bewilderment was that he did not know how to do what he set himself to do. He had decided that he wanted to serve the Lord by helping in the creation of the universe. But that was such a stupendous task. How does one go about creating the universe? That's not an easy thing to do, even for Brahma. And he too had to be empowered by the Lord. So as he was seeking and going up and down in the stem of the lotus, traveling all over and not being able to find an answer, because he was sincere, the Lord gave him guidance. He was struggling, so the Lord came to his aid. So struggle is a fact of life for everyone in this world. From top to bottom, everyone has to struggle. Whether it is for survival or it is for any other purpose, struggle is something that is inevitable. So might as well struggle for the ultimate goal of life. Might as well struggle for something that is sublime, rather than struggling for something that simply increases that struggle indefinitely, life after life. Because material existence means struggle. And the more we prolong our material existence, we simply prolong struggle and suffering. So might as well struggle for some final solution to this whole problem that we've put ourselves into. So that struggle is called penance. Struggle means it's some difficulty. But that's a difficulty that we voluntarily accept. Struggles are of two kinds. One that you're forced to do involuntarily, and the other is the one that you voluntarily do. So in any case, all living entities are being forced to struggle. They are forced to do a certain kind of penance or austerity. But because that is being forced by the laws of material nature, it doesn't yield much spiritual benefit, even though that is the intention. The question may be asked, why is there suffering in this world? Why does the Lord create a situation where every living entity is forced to suffer? In the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 13, Lord Krishna says, Janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha doshanu darshanam. One of the symptoms of real knowledge is to recognize that birth, death, old age and disease are the four basic miseries of material existence. So to recognize that these miseries are very much an integral part of our life and unavoidable, the question must be asked, why is it being forced upon us? Srila Prabhupada would insist many times that this question must be asked. Why are you being forced to die? Why are you becoming forced to get old? Why are you forced to get diseased? Why are you forced to take birth again? So this is an important philosophical point about why suffering exists in this world. And the answer is that it exists because the Lord wants to remind us again and again and yet again, time and time again, that this is not the place for you. So move out from here. Come back to your eternal abode, my kingdom, the spiritual world. Where there is no suffering, there is only bliss. Let's take a simple example. Imagine that by mistake, unknowingly, we put our finger in the fire. We are busy doing something and there's a fire nearby, maybe in the kitchen or wherever. And our finger touches the fire. What happens? Immediately the alarm bells start ringing in the brain. There's a sensation, a very strong sensation of pain. When the fire contacts the finger, physiologically some things start happening in the body, which a doctor may explain more in detail. But some things start happening in the body. There's a sensation which we understand as pain or burning. And immediately the brain acts and instructs the hand to withdraw. And we move the finger out. Now imagine, if the body was incapable of feeling the sensation of pain, what would have happened? What would have happened? The finger would have got consumed. You would have lost your finger. Actually, sometimes that happens in some cases where the sensation is lost. I remember one lady devotee in a hospital, the nurse was a little neglectful. I won't mention the country and the details. And because of some ailment, there was some heating being done on certain part of the body which had become gangrenous or something like that, some problem. And the nurse forgot to remove that heating, with the result that the entire flesh was burnt away, and because she didn't have a sensation, she lost that foot. So it happens. So when the sensation of pain is not there, we may end up losing a very valuable part of our body. Yes, it's a doctor speaking here.
Leprosy. It's already not
leprosy. Leprosy, okay.
Your sensations are
gone. Okay. So Mahatma Prabhu is a doctor. He is informing us very kindly that in leprosy also that happens. You lose sensations. So we can see that even though we don't like pain, nobody likes pain. When your finger gets burnt, you really don't like it. But imagine if that sensation wasn't there, what would have happened? So similarly, in this material existence, there's suffering and we don't like it. But it's very important. It's very valuable for us if we understand the reason. A child, when he puts his finger in the fire and gets burnt, he doesn't understand the meaning of that pain and the importance of pain. But an adult will understand, yes, it's good that I had this pain. Otherwise my finger would have been consumed. So what is the function of that pain that comes about when we put the finger in the fire? The pain tells the brain, this is not where you're supposed to be. The finger, this is not where the finger is supposed to be. Immediately take it out. So the brain acts over time, emergency, come on, yes, take it out immediately. So similarly, suffering in this world is programmed or arranged by Krishna to send alarm bells ringing in our mind. This is not where I'm supposed to be. Come out of here. This is not your place. So therefore, our whole body gets consumed. And that's death. So we die again and again and again. What to speak of a finger, the whole body is consumed eventually. And this goes on and on and on. Now you see, sometimes people become very frustrated with their suffering condition in life and they kill themselves, they commit suicide. One of the ways to commit suicide is to consume poison. Lots of people do that. They take some poisonous substance, drink it. In India, it's a little common, rat poison or some chemical fertilizers. People try all sorts of things. And they consume that because they are so fed up with the frustrations in their, with this sufferings in their life. So this is called visha. In Sanskrit, it's called visha. Poison means visha. Now, in Sanskrit, there's another word. It's called vishaya. But it means something different from visha. But it's more deadly. Vishaya means the objects of the senses. You know, we have the eyes and the ears and so on. And the eyes see form. So the form are the objects for the eye, for the sense of sight. Sound. Sound is the object for the sense of hearing, which is the ear. Taste is the object for the tongue. Touch is the object for the skin. Smell is the object for the nose. So our entire life, the life of all the species of life in this world, is engaged merely in trying to have a favorable, a pleasant contact of these senses with their objects. So we want to hear a pleasant sound. We want to have fragrant smells to smell. We want to see beautiful forms, and so on. So these sense objects in Sanskrit are called vishaya. So which of the two is more deadly? Poison or the sense objects? What do you think? Visha or vishaya? Vishaya. Why is that? Why? Yes.
Death can be repeated.
Death can be repeated. Meaning, can you elaborate? You're on the right track.
If we serve our senses, our death will not just be once. That's if we took poison. But birth and death will be repeated.
Excellent. So I think you should get some extra Mahaprasadam today. With visha or with poison, you lose your body only once. You lose this one body that's taken away from you. It's consumed. But with vishaya, the more we try to enjoy sense gratification in this world, we have to die once, but we are forced to take birth again and again and again. So with visha or poison, we lose the body once, but with vishaya, we lose the body many, many times. Indefinitely, it goes on and on in an interminable cycle, which we can stop only by devotional service. So Srila Prabhupada here is speaking a lot about how the two can't go together. Material enjoyment and devotional service cannot go hand in hand. The two go ill together. And Prabhupada says, I'll quote that. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita it is said that if someone sincerely wants to see the Lord and at the same time wants to enjoy this material world, he is considered to be a fool only. Prabhupada is mentioning here, if someone wants to sincerely see the Lord, that means he's sincere. He's not just a casual seeker of the Lord. He's sincerely seeking. But even after sincerely seeking, he still wants to enjoy the material world. He's a fool only. Sometimes devotees may even approach the Lord for material enjoyment, like Dhruva Maharaj did. He wanted a kingdom that was greater than the kingdom of his grandfather and his great-grandfather, Brahma. And when he finally saw the Lord, then he forgot everything that he came for. And he was fully satisfied with just the darshan or the audience with the Lord. Swamin kritarthosmi varam nayache. My dear Lord, now I'm completely satisfied. I have no desire to ask any material benediction from you. Kacham vichinmannapi divyaratnam. I was seeking broken pieces of glass. What a fool I was. But now I have obtained a priceless diamond, Divya Ratnam. So Krishna consciousness is like a priceless diamond. And the material enjoyment of this world, according to Dhruva Maharaj, is like broken pieces of glass. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita also, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami is quoting Lord Krishna's thinking process. And he says, Krishna thinks to himself, or rather, this is how Krishna is reasoning. Anya kame yodi kare Krishna ra bhajan, na magite hetare den Krishna svacharan. Anya kame. Kami means to desire something, one who desires something. Anya means desiring something other than Krishna consciousness. So, if someone approaches Krishna for the fulfillment of some desire that has nothing to do with Krishna consciousness, in other words, some form of material enjoyment, or maybe merging into the impersonal Brahman or something, then Anya kame yadi kare Krishna ra bhajan. So if such a person performs devotional service to Krishna, Krishna dar na magite ha Krishna tare then swacharan. So even though that person doesn't want Krishna's lotus feet, he has come for some material desire, fulfillment of some material desire, but Krishna forcibly gives his lotus feet to that devotee. Kaviraj Goswami says, Krishna kahe, ama bhaje, ehi bada murkha. He's saying, this person is worshipping me for some material enjoyment. But what a fool he is. Amrit chadi vishamage ehi bada murkha. He should come to me for the nectar of Krishna consciousness. But he's coming to me for the poison of sense gratification. What a fool he is. So, Krishna is thinking about how foolish this particular sakama bhakta or fruitive devotee is. And then he goes on to say, this devotee is a fool, but I'm not a fool. So he says, Ami vigya, e murkhe, vishaya keno dibo, so characharanamrita diya vishaya bhulaibo. So he says, this worshipper of mine who is coming to me for some material benefits is a fool. But I am not a fool. Ami vigya. I am very intelligent, Krishna says. He is the most intelligent person. Ami vigya ei murkhe vishaya keno dibo. Because I am so intelligent, why should I give this foolish devotee of mine some material enjoyment that he is seeking? Sva charanamrita diya. Giving this devotee the nectar of my lotus feet, Vishaya bhulaibo, I will make him forget sense gratification. So this is the beauty of coming to Krishna. So therefore, even if one has material desires, one should still come to Krishna rather than robbing a bank or maybe taking refuge of alcohol in times of distress or whatever. Of even going to the demigods. Some people go to the demigods for relief from distress or for fulfillment of material benefits. Ideally, one should come to Krishna with no material motive at all. But that's rare. Many people approach Krishna, but their hearts are not fully pure. So sometimes it may happen that we have some material desires to fulfill and... But if one has to ask something material, better we ask Krishna. Akama sarva kamova moksha kama udaradhi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. In the Srimad Bhagavatam it is said, whether one is akama, without any material desires, whether one is full of material desires, sarva kama, or whether one desires merging into the impersonal Brahman, moksha kama, one who is intelligent will with unflinching faith and determination, one-pointed attention, worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So even if somebody has material desires, rather than taking shelter of some sinful activity or even taking shelter of the demigods, one should take shelter only of Krishna. What is the difference between asking Krishna for the fulfillment of material desires on one hand and asking the demigods for fulfillment of material desires on the other hand? What is the difference? Anyone would like to answer? Yes, Mahatma.
When we ask Lord Krishna for fulfillment of some desire, he sees that the desire will be fulfilled, but we also become his devotee at the same time.
Okay.
The demigods, they will give you, but they will not take care of your spiritual progress.
Very nice, wonderful. So when we approach Krishna for the fulfillment of material desires, eventually by his mercy, he will take away those material desires and give us pure devotional service. I'm not encouraging that we should approach Krishna for material desires. I'm just making a philosophical point. So therefore, we become free of material desires and we can become eventually pure devotees. But that's a long way. It's a long road. Might as well take full shelter of the Lord with a pure heart. On the other hand, taking shelter of the demigods doesn't take care of the purification of the heart. The demigods are business-like. It's a business dealing. You worship them, give them what they need, and they've got the hat of their business hat at that time. They haven't got the hat as devotees. The demigods are devotees. But, you know, when they do business, then they have, you know, just like a devotee who's a businessman. When he's in the temple, he's dealing as a devotee with fellow devotees. But when he's doing business, let's say he's a shopkeeper or something, and he's selling something to a customer. Now, if he starts being generous and giving out everything free, then what's going to happen? Then he won't be able to earn his livelihood. So when he's a businessman, he does business. So he's got the hat of a businessman at that time. So when the worshippers of the demigods approach the demigods wear the hat of being businessmen, so to speak. So when they are when they receive what they want in terms of the sacrifices and so on, then they reciprocate by giving whatever benedictions that devotee or that worshipper wants. So once that benediction is given, then the demigods are through. They have no further business with that worshipper. And the desires to ask for material benediction, that doesn't go away. That remains. Let's give a simple example to illustrate this point. Let's say we have some injury on the finger or the hand and an itching sensation. And we want to scratch it and scratch it, because when we scratch an itch, it feels nice, yeah? Doesn't it? It really feels good when it gives a pleasing sensation. Just rub it, and it feels nice. But because it feels nice, if we go on rubbing it, what happens after some time? Then it becomes a festering sore. Then you'll have to go to the doctor after that, or use some antiseptics or whatever it is. But if you were to apply some ointment that would take care of the itch, that would soothe the itch and at the same time cure it and ensure that it doesn't degenerate into a sore, something that causes a major problem with the skin or something. So going to Krishna for the fulfillment of material desires is something like that. Krishna gives us the healing balm. He says, okay, I take care of your material desires, but also I'll ensure that you lose your material desires and you'll develop only pure Krishna consciousness. But the demigods don't do that. The demigods help you to scratch. Okay, I'm going to scratch you too. You scratch my back, I scratch your back. So it's a materialistic deal between the worshipper and the demigods. So there's nothing spiritual. It may be religious, but there's nothing spiritual about a materialistic worshipper of the demigods worshipping the demigods. So this is one example of how something can be religious but not spiritual. Because it has nothing to do with spirituality, it is only sense gratification. But because it's done with higher powers, those whom we can't see with our eyes, and because there are some things mentioned in the scriptures about them, so we think that it's spiritual. However, at least these people are approaching the demigods, who is some bona fide higher authority for their sense enjoyment. They're not being whimsical about it. Therefore, over a period of many, many lifetimes, they will come to the point one day of something spiritual. So it's better to be a worshipper of the demigods to enjoy material benefits than to be a whimsical enjoyer. But better than worshipping the demigods for material benefits is to worship Krishna for material benefits. And better than worshipping Krishna for material benefits is to worship Krishna out of pure love, without any material desires. That's Mahatma. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada mentions that there are five kinds of worshippers. One are the Mahatmas, who serve Krishna with pure love. Mahatmanastu mam partha, daivim prakritim ashritah, bhajantyananya manaso jnatma bhutadim avyayam. The Mahatmas of great souls are those who have taken complete shelter of the divine energy of Krishna. Daivim prakritim. So the acharyas explain, what is this daivim prakriti, divine nature? Who is that divine nature? Srimati Radharani, that's right. So the devotees, they take shelter of Srimati Radharani. In the Nectar of Devotion also, Srila Prabhupada explains that the devotees in Vrindavan take shelter of Srimati Radharani, who is a reservoir of pure devotional service to Krishna. So therefore, when the devotees, they take shelter of Krishna, then everything else is taken care of. They progress in their Krishna consciousness. They move forward. They become relieved of all their material desires. So these are the Mahatmas. The second category are those who worship Krishna for material desires, a fulfillment of some material goal. They are called the Sukritinas in chapter 7. Chaturvidha bhajante mam jana sukritino arjuna artho artharthi jignyasu jnani cha bharatarshabha. Some people, however, approach Krishna for a non-devotional purpose. Some may come because they have some misery in life which they want alleviated. Some may come for the fulfillment of some material desire. Some may come because they're inquisitive and curious. Some may come because they're situated in knowledge. They are called Sukritinas. Even these people are pious souls. That's why they come to Krishna. Otherwise, they could have adopted some sinful means for fulfilling their desires. But because they come to Krishna instead of doing that, Krishna calls them as Sukritinas. They are pious souls. So it's not common. It's not an ordinary thing that someone approaches Krishna even for the fulfillment of one's desires, material desires. So imagine how rare and how fortunate is that soul who approaches Krishna only for pure devotional service. And what kind of exalted destination such a soul will receive. So by Srila Prabhupada's mercy, we have received this good fortune. We have been shown the path of pure devotional service, devoid of any material inebrieties, which is pure. We may have material desires in the heart, doesn't matter. But because we sincerely strive to please Krishna, to please the acharyas, to please the Vaishnavas, and we are clear about the goal of pure devotional service, we are clear about Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we are clear about our eternal identity as the spirit soul, the servant of Krishna. So these material desires very quickly will go away if we simply follow the process. Srila Prabhupada is speaking at length here about such a contradiction between a devotee wanting to seek material enjoyment. Later in the concluding paragraph of the purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions that to be engaged in the penance of devotional service, one must be completely free from all sins. Then this brings us to the question. It seems like a contradiction. When one comes to devotional service, one becomes free of all sins. But if you say to come to devotional service, you have to be free of sins, then how does one get rid of those sins in the first place? So the verse from the Bhagavad Gita that talks about this is Yesham Tvandagatam Papam Jananam Punyakarmanam Te Mohadvandu Nirmukta Bhajante Mam Dridhavrataha. So unless one's sins are completely cleansed, one is free from these sins. Tu antagatam papam. Papam means sins. Antagatam means finished. Yesham tvandagatam papam jananam punyakarmanam. And unless one has accumulated sufficient piety, one cannot perform devotional service with firm determination. So this is the important part, dridhavritaha. So one may come to Krishna consciousness if one has an accumulation of certain devotional piety. But in order to be very fixed and strong and determined in the discharge of devotional service, then one needs to be free from those sins. We see many times people come to devotional service with a baggage of many bad habits from the past. And those bad habits, they haunt that devotee. And they may entice the devotee time to time to go back to the old ways. And if one's devotional service is not very strong, there is every possibility the devotee may slip and go back to those old ways. Maybe the accumulation of devotional piety is not sufficient at this point in time. But devotional service is very powerful. If the devotee serves with great intensity and sincerity, then surely the destruction of sins is a very inconsequential thing, very insignificant thing. It can happen very quickly. As far as the accumulation of sinful of piety is concerned, we must remember that this piety is not mundane piety that arises out of performing acts of mundane charity or philanthropy and so on. But this devotional piety is that which is devotional, connected to Krishna consciousness, and maybe perhaps even unknowingly accumulated. When we go out on the streets chanting Harinam, for example, there are hundreds of people who hear the chanting of the holy names. Some of them don't even know it's something spiritual. But they hear it. They may think it's just good music. They like it. They benefit. Some people know it's something to do with spirituality. But they really don't know much, and neither are they interested to know also. But they still get some benefit. So they're hearing the holy names. So they have started accumulating that devotional piety. That is called Ajnata Sukriti. So devotional piety is called Sukriti. So in that verse that I quoted, Chaturvidha Bhajante Mam Jana Sukritino Arjuna, that the devotees who worship Krishna for fulfillment of material desires are called Sukritinas. They have some devotional pieties, therefore they are approaching Krishna and not someone else. So this devotional piety may sometimes arise even unknowingly. Like a passerby on the street who hears the Harinam. So he's hearing Krishna's names. He gets some prasadam offered by the devotees. He just takes it as a nice cookie or a nice sweet or something. He or she doesn't realize the spiritual significance of that. But when that person takes the prasadam, then there is spiritual benefit. Even simply by appreciating the devotee is saying, even in their mind to think, oh, these people are, as you say, cool. They're nice, they're good. That person's devotional life has begun. The Ajnata Sukriti has taken effect. So Rupa Goswami says, Adau Shraddha Tatah Sadhu Sangha. Because of that little faith, that little Shraddha, one day they will come to the association of devotees. Perhaps in this life, maybe the next life. But they will come sooner or later. When that accumulated devotional piety grows to a certain level. Of course, we can also... There's different categories of people who will come to different levels in Krishna consciousness. Some will just be at the level of accumulating devotional piety, and we will have to wait for a future lifetime for them to come to Krishna consciousness actively. And some, they just hear it once and they just become devotees. It happens, I know of some devotees who just heard it once and started chanting 16 rounds from that day. But that's generally rare. We don't find too many cases. Mostly, why, how do we know? How do you know Krishna is God? How do you know we are the soul? And, but what about this and what about that? And so that's the natural way most people would do it. For some people, it's just like fish taking to water. They just take to it and there's something from the previous life, they are ready now. The devotional piety has accumulated sufficiently. They are ready for Krishna now. And there comes along the party of devotees chanting Harinam. And that's it. Their material life is finished. So that's our penance, as Srila Prabhupada explains. Krishna consciousness. And once we do that, with all sincerity, Krishna is pleased. We continue to make advancement and our human life becomes perfect. Thank you very much. We'll stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Yes. Say that again. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, what? Can you say that again? You can locate that particular sentence. Yes. How can Srila Prabhupada says that love and penance both are required to please the Lord and obtain His mercy? So how can we do both? By doing exactly what? How can we combine love and penance? When the penance is performed out of love, you combine both. Yes? Let's say you're fasting, you fast out of love. You're cleaning the temple, you're lifting buckets to to Crossways. You're serving our prasadam. Or you're cleaning the courtyard of the temple. Or even you're chanting your rounds and fighting sleep because you had less sleep last night, but you try to chant sincerely. It's penance when you're trying to do something that's difficult to do, but you're doing it as a labor of love. Not as a burden, but out of love. So that's a sincere expression of our desire to please the Lord. So that's the combination of love and penance. Okay? Any questions? Any other questions? Yes. Yes.
What is the exact difference between the inquisitive and the one in knowledge? Because I would assume that the one who's inquisitive would also have some knowledge, and the one in knowledge will be inquisitive as well. So what is the...
Okay, so the question is that in the four categories of pious souls who approach Krishna, what is the difference between the third and fourth categories, which means the inquisitive, Jigyasu, on one hand, and the Jnani, which means the one in knowledge, on the other, because it seems that the Jigyasu, the inquisitive person, will have some knowledge, and the knowledgeable person will also have some inquisitiveness. The answer is that the inquisitive person is generally not so well versed with knowledge. He's seeking. But even his seeking may or may not be so serious. And even if it is serious, at the time of starting out, he isn't so well versed with the understanding. And is not so firmly situated in knowledge. But the Jnani is already situated in knowledge. So of the four categories, the Jnani, Krishna says, is the best. Okay. Any other question? Yes. Of austerity. Okay. So your question is it possible for us to attain the level of austerities that the six Goswamis did in Vrindavan? Yes? Like you mentioned that Raghunath Das Goswami used to have a glass or a cup of buttermilk. Well, actually he would sometimes have a palm full of buttermilk or a glass, and that also sometimes every 2 or 3 days if he remembered to. So I think that should answer your question. That is it possible for us to do it in this day and age for us? The answer is very clearly no. We cannot try to artificially imitate the six Goswamis. Neither can we try to imitate the great souls of the Bhagavatam from earlier ages. I remember one devotee. He became so inspired after reading Dhruva Maharaj's story that he decided he wouldn't sleep lying down. So he would sit in the temple hall at night and sleep, you know, sitting up. So he would do that. He managed to pull on for... That was a whimsical kind of austerity, because that's not really something that's recommended for us. So he wanted to do that and sit up. He would sit. He decided he wouldn't lie down to sleep, because he felt he could do what people did in earlier ages. So he was sitting up, and then finally all day long he was very, you know, irritable and always quarreling with everyone because he hadn't slept. So he was, you know, he wasn't in good shape. So naturally we can't imitate the six Goswamis. We would die, very simply. I mean, bluntly put, we would die. I mean, as Kali Yuga goes on, the bodies are just not able to do the kind of austerities that were done even 50 years ago, what to speak of 500 years ago. And secondly, they were so exalted, they were eternal associates of the Lord. So it's a different situation altogether. We should follow the balanced program that Srila Prabhupada has recommended for us, which is very practical, keeping in mind the modern situation of our bodies, of the environment, and so on. So that's good enough for us. The question is, the process is perfect. If it worked for them, why wouldn't it work for us? Because the times are different. Because conditions are different. The process works, but our body doesn't work the same way. Our minds don't work the same way. The circumstances today are not the same as what they were 500 years ago. So therefore, things are different. We also see that in a larger scheme of things. Therefore, the processes for self-realization are different for the four ages. What was recommended for Satya Yuga was not recommended for Kali Yuga, because the bodies and the atmosphere in this age are just not up to it. So therefore, we have a far simpler process to attain self-realization. It's also more sublime. Any other questions? Yes, Anirudha Prabhu.
So, the austerities that personalities like Rabindranath Das performed weren't difficult for him in that he was so absorbed in his devotional
practices.
Internally, that he was pretty much disconnected from what was going on externally.
Right. Yes.
Not just, you know, we might think, okay, I'll fast for 3 days, but it's external, it's not internal.
Yes. Because he was so absorbed in Krishna consciousness that he didn't even sometimes remember. So when the Krishna consciousness is at that level, that exalted, then one can transcend the bodily limitations. But as I mentioned, because they were eternal associates, their Krishna consciousness was in a different league. So we can't imitate that. But I'll tell you one little episode, one little pastime. One time Raghunath Das Goswami fell sick. And, you know, an Ayurvedic doctor was called. The local Babajis who assisted Raghunath Das Goswami, who really worshipped him and held him in very high regard. They called an Ayurvedic doctor. The doctor examined his pulse and everything and said he has indigestion. He has overeaten. So the other Babaji said, "What on earth are you talking about? Indigestion. He doesn't eat anything. He hasn't eaten anything for 3 days. He just takes a little buttermilk, a little at the end. How can he have indigestion?" So the Ayurvedic doctor said, "You know, this is, my science is perfect. I have not made any mistake. Now it's up to you to decide what he's done, what he's not done. But as a doctor, I'm telling you that he's got indigestion." So then they asked Raghunath Das Goswami, "He's saying this, so what's going on here?" So then Raghunath Goswami said, "Oh yes, I was meditating on the pastime of Krishna, and then I had cooked and I had taken a lot of sweet rice in his meditation, not physically. In his meditation, he had consumed some nectarian mahaprasadam, sweet rice that he had offered to Radha and Krishna. So because he'd done it in his meditation, so he was completely fed. His body was nourished because of that." So perhaps if we try to get some solace in our day of fasting by thinking of sweet rice, it makes it worse, yeah? We are fasting and you're waiting, when will the prasadam be? And we're thinking, let me do what Raghunath Goswami did and let me meditate on Mahaprasadam, and then it doesn't work out. Then we just rush and say, we've got to have that Mahaprasadam now. Yes, Anil. We go there and?
Go without a bit of sleep.
Go without a bit of sleep.
Manage to survive a day or two.
Yes.
And then we start thinking, I'm really advanced, or because sannyasi visits and they're busy doing things and running around. We think, but then when they go, we crash. So it's kind of, there's quite a bit of difference between the two.
Yes, yes. So we do undergo some austerities, but that doesn't sustain. It's not easy to sustain. But Raghunath Das Goswami's austerity was sustained. It was natural for him. It went on and on. Even Rup Jiva Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, they were really very simple. The other day I was narrating the story of Madan Mohan and Sanatan Goswami. He would just give whatever he got. Sometimes he made a little chapati, sometimes he didn't, you know. And then he would offer that to Madan Mohan, his worshipable deity. And Madan Mohan one time told him, look, Sanatan, you're feeding me, at least put some salt in the chapati, you know. And then Sanatan told him, you know, well, you know, see, I'm a mendicant. I can only feed you what you send to me. If you arrange for me to get this bhoga, what can I do? I can feed you this. So today you're asking me for salt. Tomorrow you'll ask me for sugar. So be satisfied with what I'm giving you now. So Sanatan Goswami was also satisfied, and he made Krishna also satisfied by eating just simple, very, very simple food. But again, we can't imitate Sanatan. We have to be very careful when we offer our Rajbhog. We can't tell Krishna, you know, just make do with what we're giving. Okay, so, yes, one last question. Can you say that again? Many of? Would end up in the heavenly planets? Your question is that Prabhupada said that many of his disciples would end up in the heavenly planets. I don't know about such a quote. I haven't heard, maybe. But usually, if the disciple becomes a pure devotee, then he or she goes back to Godhead, right? If the devotee doesn't go back to Godhead because the devotional service has remained incomplete, not 100%, but if that devotee has performed very dedicated devotional service, then it's expected that in the next life the devotee will be born in a Vaishnava family rather than going to the heavenly planets. Now there are two kinds of destinations that unsuccessful devotees can attain according to the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And there's a distinction between the two. Those who perform very little advancement in Krishna consciousness are born in the higher planet. Shuchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Bhrashto Vijayate. So they take birth in the heavenly planets, and then they come back. They come back on the earthly planet. Those who are more advanced, they take birth in devotee families. That's Krishna's judgment. That Krishna decides who will take birth where, whether we go to the heavenly planets or not. Actually, going to the heavenly planets is a distraction. And it's a lot of time that's gone because we have only 10,000 years left. before the Kali Yuga stops it, and by the time you go to the heavenly planets and come back, it's the Kali Yuga is over. So I don't know about this quote, but it's most likely that everybody who has taken Krishna consciousness seriously in this life and who has somehow not been able to complete it would get a birth in a devotee family. Again, if they haven't gone back to Godhead. That's the more likely thing, unless someone has not at all taken it seriously. So been very casual about it. Then that such a devotee may take birth in the heavenly planets. Yes. Yes. Come out of it. Okay, the question is that there is, seems to be a natural correlation or a connection between the senses and the sense objects. And we see there are some examples like Bilwa Mangal Thakur, who gouged his eyes out so that the eyes wouldn't be able to distract him from his Krishna consciousness. Then how does one understand that? These are very extreme examples in history. And certainly it is not recommended that we should try to imitate Bilwa Mangal Thakur. Bilwa Mangal Thakur took that extreme step because he was so, so intensely wanting Krishna. And then all of a sudden this distraction came up, his old desires came up, and then he became so frustrated with himself that he just did that. But that is certainly not recommended. What happens in the lives of very exalted souls are special cases. And one doesn't imitate special cases like that. One rather follows in the footsteps by following their devotional examples. His natural attraction to Krishna is what we should try to imbibe. So the solution for us is to engage our senses with sense objects by dovetailing them in Krishna consciousness. We can't do without the senses. Actually, we can't do without sense gratification.